Hi there, it's John Donvan, in today for Joshua Johnson. We want to let you know this conversation was recorded earlier today, and the news is moving fast. NPR will keep you up to date over the weekend, and you can follow us on Twitter at 1A. This is 1A. I'm John Donvan in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. And for President Trump, it has been a week for super important decisions. One of them, run for a second term. That one's a yes. He announced at a raucous rally he's taking on a second term. But there is the to-the-brink question of Iran. It's attack or don't attack. And the president, citing the cost in lives, has apparently pulled back from that brink for now. Meanwhile, we are days away from the first Democratic debates, a huge field on a big stage with some candidates clamoring for headlines in their own special ways. It's the Friday News Roundup, and joining me today is Susan Glasser. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and a global affairs analyst for CNN. Susan, welcome back.
Great to be here.
And Darlene Superville, a White House reporter for the Associated Press. Darlene, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, you.
And David Lightman, congressional correspondent for McClatchy. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So as we go to air, the feeling of tension here in Washington and I think globally over the sense that's been building for weeks, if not months, about the possibility of military conflict with Iran reached a new height, and then a slight puncturing of that tension. Let's look at where we are at this point. In a series of tweets this morning, President Trump confirmed that he had made plans to strike back at Iran for what the U.S. says was the downing of a U.S. drone. That's not in contention. Both sides acknowledge that Iran did shoot down a U.S. drone this week. But then he pulled back. He rescinded the order. This was his tweet. He said, "We were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night on three different sites. When I asked how many will die, 150 people, sir, was the answer from a general. 10 minutes before the strike, I stopped it. Not proportionate to shooting down an unmanned drone." Again, that's the president's tweet. Darlene, what more do we know now? Do we know what the targets would have been?
I don't know exactly what the targets would have been, but there was some speculation that we would have hit missile sites and Iranian military assets that would, you know, maybe prevent them from shooting down another drone or something like that.
And what signals has the president been sending about his I don't want to say enthusiasm, but his commitment to taking action? It has really felt rather ambivalent for the last several days.
That's correct. If you listen to the president just yesterday, he opened the day by tweeting that Iran made a big mistake, right? Which kind of led a lot of us who cover the president and the White House to think something big is going to happen. You know, we're going to respond in a big way. And then hours later, he was in the Oval Office with the Canadian Prime Minister, who happened to be visiting. And then the president kind of stepped back a little bit and said he thought the downing of the drone was a mistake.
And he meant mistake in a completely different way this time.
Mm-hmm. In a completely opposite way. And he thought it, or sort of speculated that it might have been done by someone who he said was loose and stupid.
Susan Glasser, what do you make of, again, that seeming ambivalence?
Well, I think President Trump is in argument both with himself and with his key foreign policy advisors. And as with any crisis, this is the moment when much is revealed, because you see exactly what the strengths and weaknesses of the team is that's making the decisions. You see what the process is. And none of it reflects well, of course, at the moment on President Trump. He doesn't have a real defense secretary in place. In fact, it was only this Monday, it seems like an eon ago, but in fact, it was only this Monday that nomination of his acting defense secretary, Pat Shanahan, blew up on the tarmac, as it were, and he had to withdraw because of allegations of domestic abuse within his family, which were known about apparently for quite some time. This is the longest in the history of the position of defense secretary that it has been vacant, and it's very directly relevant to that astonishing tweet that you just read out loud from this morning. Why is it relevant? Well, the president of the United States, first of all, is talking publicly about things that presidents don't normally talk about. Mm-hmm. And he is telling us that 10 minutes before an operation that he had already authorized a military strike with Iran. This isn't just like some tiny pinprick strike in the middle of Syria. This is with Iran, the major actor in the Middle East, that he had already authorized a military operation without knowing what the potential casualties were. That is a malfeasance of duty. This is one of the most extraordinary public admissions I've ever seen about our national security. It reflects very poorly on the national security process, obviously. What was the decision-making process? What does it mean about the Pentagon? Did they actually not brief the President of the United States on what the potential consequences were of the military action that he had already given an order to authorize? This is an incredible moment in our national history.
David Lightman, let's step back. And it was such a complex week. There were so many steps to leading up to this moment, beginning with this report of attacks on two tankers out in the Gulf. What happened? What do we know about those attacks? And then what happened next?
Well, what we know is that first there was somewhat of a dispute over was it over international waters? Was it over Iranian territory?
Are you talking about the drone?
Yes.
Oh, I wanted to go back even further to where the tension really began to escalate and the attack on the tankers.
Last week, I think it was. But in any event, what you had, the tension began to escalate, and I cover Congress. Congress really didn't know quite what to do. Mm-hmm. And let me fast forward,
because
I think what happened yesterday at this meeting between the Intelligence Committee members, Armed Services members, leaders, advisors to President Trump, what happened there is interesting because you had all these people talking and they came out not with the usual sort of political statements, not with the talking points, not with the messaging, but Mitch McConnell came out and said we need a measured response after hearing this whole history. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, came out and said, we need debate. We need to talk to our allies. So again, the members of Congress were very measured in their comments, taking all this in. It was almost encouraging, I might say, because again, you had this entire history all there. And I wonder if our other guests know, how much that actually influenced the president, because it was a very sobering meeting.
It's a good question. What do you think on that, Darlene?
That's an interesting question. I mean, he obviously would have to have listened to the members of Congress because he did have quite a few of them into the White House yesterday to talk about Iran and potential U.S. responses. And some of the members that left the White House later said that he did listen to what they had to say. Whether he internalized that or not is not something that's yet known. But we'll see.
We have Brian from Bartlett, New Hampshire, asks this question. Did Trump actually call off a strike in the nick of time, or is this just more macho bluster? Susan, you've already said, regardless, you think it's somewhat frightening, horrifying that the process unfolded this way and is being described this way.
Well, again, what I'm saying is that it's unprecedented and that it is a remarkable situation, regardless of the merits of the decision. And that's where I think your commentary is onto something, because we don't know how the story ends yet. And I think we're actually very much in the middle of this response. Why? Well, first of all, the president is, as we know, highly influenced by the media, more so than members of Congress, sad to say, for Congress. It seems to me that how he sees this decision playing out is likely to influence his future decisions as much as any private feedback he's getting from Democratic members of Congress. It's much more the Fox and Friends vote that might matter to him, the public response. You see him responding on Twitter. There's a very defensive tone to what he's saying this morning that I think is notable and may influence where we go in this crisis. For example, he led off his Twitter storm telling the nation and the world about his decision by talking about President Obama. Why? Because many commenters are noting some striking parallels between President Trump's last-minute decision to halt this military strike and President Obama's last-minute decision to avert a military strike in Syria in response to a chemical weapons attack.
And the red line.
This was the famous red line that Donald Trump has made in some ways the cornerstone of his own policy thinking when it comes to the Middle East and military interventions. He was strikingly critical of President Obama, specifically for appearing to threaten the use of force and then backing off. Well, now that's exactly what Donald Trump has done. So he's quite defensive in terms of his description description. Now, we don't know. Does that mean that he may be likelier to go ahead and order some kind of more restrained or focused military response in order to show the Iranians that he didn't actually back down but simply wanted to recalibrate this? We don't know, but that's certainly an option I wouldn't discount.
Isn't this a president, though, who from his campaign in 2016, was already saying that he was not very enthusiastic about military action in general? This was not his thing.
I think, keep in mind, this is the first president we've had since Eisenhower without government experience. And Eisenhower, of course, was a military general. So this is, I don't want to say he's naive, but this is new to him. And the idea that the commander-in-chief can launch a strike that could result in lost lives is just a huge concept for him to bear. It's a hard thing. You know, we talk about how he likes to make these spur-of-the-moment decisions and quick tweets, but, boy, that kind of responsibility, any president will tell you, is difficult, to put it mildly.
It is a hard thing, but remember, President Trump has already authorized military strikes twice since he's been president, and they were both on Syria after Assad, President Assad, used chemical weapons on his individual. So the question of whether to strike Iran or not is not that new in that context, given that he's done this already. Mm-hmm. There must be something else, other considerations at play that stopped him this time.
Well, I would point out there's a huge difference between deciding to authorize a military strike against Iran and authorizing a military strike inside of an ongoing civil war zone in Syria where the U.S., and the Israelis have acted before. This would be an escalation, risking the possibility of a wider conflict with a major regional power in a way that previous decisions President Trump has faced have not caused him to, first of all. So I do think the consequences of this, you know, would have been presented to him as much more potentially significant than any decision he has yet made regarding use of force.
More when we return. I'm John Donvan. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Home Instead Senior Care. Gerontologist and caregiver advocate Lakeland Hogan reflects on Home Instead's mission to enhance the lives of aging adults and their families.
You don't stop living once you hit a certain age. You can still live a rich, meaningful life through your later years. And so we are really excited to be celebrating our 25th anniversary at Home Instead and to be still working towards our mission.
To learn more about Home Instead Senior Care, go to homeinstead.com.
When you're paying for college on your own, there's a lot to balance. To help you get through it all, NPR's Life Kit talked to the real experts, students.
Finding a side hustle that works for you and works for your schedule is hugely beneficial.
Find Life Kit's new guide on how to pay for college in Apple Podcasts or at npr.org/lifekit.
This is 1A. I'm John Donvan in for Joshua Johnson, and it's the Friday News Roundup with David Lightman, Chief Congressional Correspondent for McClatchy, Associated Press White House reporter Darlene Superville, and CNN Global Affairs Analyst Susan Glasser, who is also a staff writer for The New Yorker. Well, the president officially launched his 2020 reelection campaign on Tuesday with a rally in Orlando, Florida.
With every ounce of heart and might and sweat and soul, we're going to keep making America great again. And then we will indeed keep America great. We will keep it so great. Better than ever before. We're going to keep it better than ever before. And that is why tonight I stand before you to officially launch my campaign for a second term as President of the United States.
Oh, it sounds like a change in slogan, Keep America Great, which is an endorsement in the president's view of his current term in office. We could hear, Darlene, the enthusiasm of that crowd. What do we know about that? What I know about that crowd is that there were people who waited more than 24 hours to get into that.
Yeah, they waited more than 24 hours. They withstood torrential downpours, rain downpours, Monday and Tuesday. I happened to be in Orlando, Florida, but not for the rally. I have family there and was visiting over the weekend, so I was seeing a lot of the news reports about people pulling their suitcases and building, you know, putting up tents and just sort of creating this party-like atmosphere outside the rally. But his supporters are in his corner, no matter what.
What about that, David?
Well, they are in his corner, but a journalistic secret. One of the things I found in 2016 to gauge support for Donald Trump isn't so much going to the rallies. Those are the believers. But if you go out the next day and see how it reverberated mm-hmm. and talk to people, number one, you see what they might remember, what's stuck. But number two, you would find, particularly in white suburbs, college-educated people who supposedly aren't voting for Trump in big numbers. But what you found in 2016 was they wouldn't say, gee, I'm for Donald Trump. They either wouldn't say who they were for or they say, I don't like Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. They're sort of winking at you. And so I'm curious, journalistically, to go out again the day after Trump rallies into some of these swing areas and talking to people and seeing if they're talking to me in that sort of code, if you know what I mean.
And your paper did this project that looks as though it's directly related yeah. to hooking up government spending with electoral politics.
Thank you for bringing that up. That's fascinating on several levels. We found that this transportation grant program, begun during the economic recovery by President Obama, to promote different ways of building roads, pedestrian walkways, bridges, and so forth. Under Obama, it was roughly 80-20 urban. Under Trump, it's become 2-1 rural. And 25 of the 30 states that Trump carried in 2016 have gotten bigger shares of this money, mostly for road building projects. This allows the president, frankly, to go to these states and say, look, see this road now that's 8 lanes instead of 4? See this project at the riverfront? My money helped you build that. Mm. In Kentucky, for example, where the Secretary of Transportation and her husband, the majority leader, live, they got only 6 projects approved under Obama. In the 2 Trump years, they've gotten 4. But none of the projects are in the state's 2 biggest cities, Lexington and Louisville. So this is the kind of thing I think you're going to see throughout this campaign.
And speaking of money, Susan Glasser, the president raised $25 million on the first day. That's astounding. What else? What does that tell us?
Well, this is, I think, traditionally referred to as the advantages of incumbency in both cases, using the power of government grants and using the power of the office. People are a lot more interested in giving money to the incumbent president of the United States than they were. Donald Trump was not a big fundraiser in his 2016 race. He even had to loan his own campaign money, which he was very reluctant to do. You won't have that issue for him this time. You know, I listened to all of the president's rally speech the other day in Orlando. And what was striking was that he wasn't really pitching his campaign in any way to independent, to up for grab states, for those people who are on the fence about him. He is running a whole campaign, as he confirmed later in his interview with Time magazine. He's running an entire campaign around stirring up the passions of his already fervent base of voters. Now, the math on the one hand would seem to be not good for him, and this would seem to make no sense as a strategy. He has a pretty strong ceiling of around 40%, mm-hmm. a little bit more at most, of the vote. And that means there's almost 2/3 of the country that is not a fervent Trump supporter. So how can you win in a democracy with those numbers? The flip side is, of course, you have to beat somebody with somebody. And right now, a generic Democrat may well do better than any actual Democratic nominee. But again, in Trump's rally, it was a very dark vision of America. Usually presidents, especially if they're running on the theme of keep America great again and that I've made America great, you would imagine that there would be a more upbeat message. Therefore, I've done all these great things and the country's looking well. This is the Ronald Reagan 1984 re-election playbook. Happy days are here again. But no. Donald Trump's was almost like a reprise of his American Carnage inaugural address, in that it was a very much a like grievance-filled narrative to his supporters. They're trying to stop us. The swamp, the deep state are pushing back on me, and that's why you need to send me to Washington again. So
again,
it's an interesting
yep.
strategy for an incumbent.
Let's take a look over on the Democratic side, and let's focus for a moment on Joe Biden, former vice president, who has been the apparent front runner among the many, many Democrats running for president. But he's in a little bit of hot water for comments that he made on Tuesday at a fundraiser where he started talking about his personal history working with members of the Senate during his early years. And these members of the Senate were also staunch segregationists. They included James O. Eastland of Mississippi. And Biden was quoted as saying that, and sort of boasting that Eastland never called me boy. He always called me son. You can go down a list of all these guys. Well, guess what? At least there was some civility. And he really, really took a lot of heat from this, from including from some of his opponents, including Senator Cory Booker. Cory Booker has told and is telling the story of his own parents facing racial discrimination in New Jersey when they were trying to move into a white neighborhood. So all of this is very, very personal and real to Booker. And Booker called on Biden to apologize. And this was how Biden responded.
Apologize for what? Cory should apologize. He knows better. There's not a racist bone in my body. I've been involved in civil rights my whole career. Period. Period. Period.
Darlene Superville, how much is this going to linger for Biden, do you think?
I think it will linger for a while. This weekend, he's scheduled to go to South Carolina, as many of the other Democratic presidential candidates are doing, to attend the annual fish fry that's sponsored by House Majority, I think he's the whip, Jim Clyburn of South Carolina. So they'll all be there. South Carolina is an important state in the early primary, among the early primary states. It has a large proportion of black voters. And I'm sure that this will come up when Biden is there. And then immediately after this fish fry weekend, you alluded to earlier, is the first Democratic presidential debate, and that's sure to come up there as well. So Biden has been on the defensive, and I think he'll continue to be on the defensive for some time.
Does he? What would you say is his standing with African American voters, broadly speaking? You know, given his own claim that his record on supporting civil rights is, he says, is very strong, given his close relationship with the first African-American president. Where does the balance fall for him on this?
I think there is a lot of goodwill for Biden, just for some of those reasons that you've talked about. And what most people remember now is that he was vice president for 8 years for the first African-American president this country has ever had. And that is going to carry over in his favor.
David Lightman, Biden has, we heard him not apologize. We heard him say, I'm not going to apologize. And that's kind of a strategy he's been using when he gets into hot water. Risky, or does it work?
Well, I think it's from the gut. You know, Biden, like so many veteran senators who try to run for president, can't untether himself from, A, the Senate, where things are done in a very collegial manner, no matter who you are, even to this in this day and age. And he can't untether himself from the past. I mean, he came of age in the 60s and 70s when things were different. I know personally I'm not as old as him, but I'm close. And it's just hard to just divorce yourself from that. So he doesn't seem to get why this is so upsetting in 2019. Times have changed. Standards have changed. And the question is, can he change with it? Real quick, back in 2008, when he ran for president, I remember you would go to Biden rallies and he would pack the place. People would literally be outside the doors because they loved hearing his stories, his anecdotes, his tales. This is before Obama put him on the ticket, but they didn't vote for him. They had affection for him. Mm-hmm. They appreciated what he did, but he was like an historic figure who came to town, and I wonder if he can overcome that this time.
So we have this Democratic presidential debate event, double events happening next week over two nights, June 26th and June 27th in Miami. The rules having been made by the Democratic National Committee itself, controversial because it's the ways that they've come up to divide first of all, to choose who gets to be on the stage and to divide between nights who gets to be with whom. It's all worked out so that the big names on the first night will be Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke and Amy Klobuchar. On the second night, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and Pete Buttigieg. Susan, what sticks out for you about who gets to debate with who and Who's advantaged or disadvantaged by this arrangement?
Well, I guess Donald Trump would say he's advantaged by the whole thing. He apparently plans to insert himself into the middle of the conversation by even considering live tweeting this, certainly reaffirming his view of himself as sort of the national pundit in chief of our entire national political debate. But, you know, so you have this two-night extravaganza, as you said. We know who's on what stage. We even know the lineup of who's going to be sitting where. You'll have Elizabeth Warren in the middle, both metaphorically and physically. And then the next day you'll have Joe Biden in the middle, metaphorically and physically, you know, on the stage. And it seems to me that there's enormous risk, of course, for Joe Biden going into this. Not only has he had a pretty terrible week headed into it, it might be a week that is not necessarily of consequence. We don't know what the long-term effects of this gaffe are in talking about Senators Eastland and Talmadge. But certainly it's been a terrible lead-up to the debate for Joe Biden. So he'll have even more to prove. Is he a real front runner or is he a weak front runner? Is he a Jeb Bush in this scenario or is he a Donald Trump in this scenario? And we don't know the answer to that yet. But I think this is going to be an important winnowing moment for this gigantic Democratic field.
Another one of the people who will be on the debate stage next week on night two, Pete Buttigieg, he's got a little bit of an issue now to challenge his the things he's going to have to say in public. Back in his hometown where he's mayor, South Bend, Indiana, a white police officer shot and killed a black man Sunday. And as a result of that, Buttigieg has canceled several days of campaigning. He's gone back there. The decision is seen as wise for him, but Buttigieg has faced criticism in the past for how he's handled incidents like that within the community in South Bend. And some people are calling it a nightmare for him. So why is this a nightmare for him? How has he handled that situation?
I think, without knowing obviously all the facts here, I think it's I don't know if it's a nightmare, but it's a test. This is a chance to see this guy in action. Mm-hmm. So far, he's impressed with his speeches and the fact, frankly, that he's 37 years old and he has a terrific resume, et cetera, et cetera. But unlike a Joe Biden or a Senator Harris or a Senator Warren, we don't know much about his record, how he's performed under fire. Now we get to see how he performs under fire. So I think it's a big moment for him.
Darlene, how can you get this right or wrong?
Well, I was going to say that I don't see how he could do anything else but leave the campaign trail and go back to South Bend and deal with this. He is still mayor of the city, and it was an important thing that happened that needed his leadership to deal with it. But back to your question, one of the other things with this situation is that it also, you know, Pete Buttigieg has had some issues with black support, and his handling of this situation could tip the scales on that one way or the other.
What are his challenges with black support? What are the issues?
He's not very well known among the black community. There are some particularly older African Americans who are not fond of gays and lesbians. That is a challenge for him. Youth, I think, is another one that speaks to some of the older African Americans and some of the people that he will encounter again this weekend when he goes to South Carolina. And he does plan to be there, from what I understand.
Earlier in the program, when we were talking about Iran, it was mentioned that we don't have a defense secretary, and we have about a minute to discuss this before we go up to break. But the president tweeted this week that he was withdrawing the nomination of Patrick Shanahan, who had been in line to be the permanent defense secretary. The FBI had been looking into his background. There were stories of domestic violence. Susan, what happened? Why was he pulled? And again, we have about a minute.
Yeah, well, he, had this extraordinary, horrifying tale. You can read, I urge you to read, a very powerful Washington Post account in which he
gave interviews.
It's a very difficult story. Also there, it reflects his view, obviously, of this very painful situation with his former wife, with his son. It's really, it's awful. Questions naturally arise. Number one, he knew about this. He now says he didn't want to put his family through this. Well, now it's all come out. If that was really the case, then why did he agree to go through with the nomination months ago? Also, he's already been through an FBI investigation and a confirmation hearing to become Deputy Secretary of Defense. So naturally, Congress and others will have questions about why is it that the FBI did not air this investigation before, especially given that there have been some high-profile cases already in the Trump administration of domestic violence allegations with senior officials in the Trump administration. And then, of course, there's the substantive issue, which is what does it mean for the country not to have a Secretary of Defense at such a volatile and uncertain moment for longer than ever before in history? Trump has a predilection for not appointing permanent appointees, but just naming acting officials. His White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, still has the acting in his title. It's a way of circumventing the Constitution's decree that these appointments should be confirmed by the Senate.
And before we take the break, Mark on our Facebook page writes, can we acknowledge the fact that the president is currently acting as his own Secretary of Defense? Interesting point, interesting question. Coming up, we'll be looking at a controversial congresswoman's latest controversial comments. More of the Friday News Roundup is next. Stay with us.
In the Trump era, the news moves faster than ever, and the NPR Politics podcast is there to keep you informed. Every time there's a major political story, we get our best correspondents together to sort through the noise. The NPR Politics podcast, what you need to know right after it happens.
This is 1A. I'm John Donvan. It's the Friday News Roundup with David Lightman, chief congressional correspondent from McClatchy, Darlene Superville, White House reporter for the Associated Press, Susan Glasser, staff writer for The New Yorker and a global affairs analyst for CNN. We're going down the home stretch, but we still have a lot of ground to cover. The Environmental Protection Agency, its administrator, Andrew Wheeler, announced a new regulation this week. It's called the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, and it dismantles President Obama's key policy that was designed to reduce carbon emissions. Here is Administrator Wheeler on Wednesday.
Rather than punishing U.S. production and yielding the marketplace to Chinese coal, which is what the Obama Clean Power Plan did, we are leveling the playing field and encouraging innovation and technology across the sector.
David Lightman, Mr. Wheeler saying that it levels the playing field. What does the rule actually do?
Well, it eases restrictions on coal-fired power plants. This basically reverses the Obama-era policy. On a broader level, though, it also deals with climate change. It deals with global warming, and I think that's the context this debate's going to proceed. It gives states more leeway, really, in deciding whether to require plants to make these upgrades. Already, one state has said they're going to challenge this in court. I suspect they will. But in the meantime, President Trump campaigned on reviving the coal industry, and there's a lot of climate change doubters. What was interesting, by the way, I think this is worth noting, that on the same day that this was announced, Kelly Craft, the president's nominee for UN ambassador, was testifying in the Senate and saying that human behavior plays a major role in climate change. And she said climate change needs to be addressed. So here we have mixed messages from the administration on the same day.
Darlene Superville, the President Obama's plan faced a lot of litigation from states and from private industry groups. Could this new rule also run into the same sort of litigation wall?
Absolutely. I think so. Yes, from people on the other side, those who wanted the rule and now are going to see it be taken away under President Trump's action.
It's speculative, but is this something that could get as high as the Supreme Court?
I suppose it's possible, but probably too early to say, yes.
Okay. So also in Congress this week, the House Judiciary Committee oversaw a hearing on H.R. 40, and that's a piece of legislation that would study the idea of reparations for the descendants of enslaved Africans. This hearing, by the way, took place on Juneteenth, and that's a holiday that marks the day when all American slaves were finally emancipated. This has been an issue that Congress has been sort of punting on for a long time, maybe a matter of decades. But let's listen to Julianne Malvo, who testified there. She's an economist and the former president of Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina.
I'm proud of my family, too. I mean, we good black people, too. I have a PhD, I have two MBAs in my family, blah, blah. I'm not going to give you my family history. But it is irrelevant. It is irrelevant when you're dealing with structure. I want y'all Congress people to deal with issues of economic structure, and an economic structure has generated an inequality that makes it difficult for people to live their lives. When zip code determines what kind of school that you go to, when zip code determines what kind of food you can eat, these are the vestiges of enslavement that a lot of people don't want to deal with.
You hear in Ms. Malveaux's voice, and also just watching clips from this hearing, this was an incredibly intense hearing. Were any of you actually there in the room for that?
I wasn't in the room, but no. I'm well aware of what happened.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
It was intense on several levels. First, the emotional level, because there was a feeling, gee, the House is taking us seriously. Not just a hearing, but it's not one of these hearings that you call to pay lip service to an issue. This is a serious matter. And remember, the bill itself does not offer cash to people. It sets up a commission, which is a very tidy political way of dealing with this at the moment. And it's gaining a lot of support, a lot more than this might have had. I think further in
Why is that? Why is it gaining support now?
For a lot of reasons. First of all, I think it was inflamed earlier in the week when Senator McConnell, the majority leader, said none of us are currently responsible for slavery, that you had President Obama. So, in other words, things have worked out, so to speak. And I think that partially inflamed. Also, you're beginning a presidential race. And the African-American vote, as you know, is huge, both in numbers and in influence. And this is a way of showing some sensitivity to that issue. And again, a commission is not a federal financial obligation. It's a study. Mm-hmm. So it's politically safer.
Are some of those nuances being missed, Darlene, do you think?
That's an interesting question. Probably I would say yes. When people talk about reparations, they automatically leap to money and who will get it and how do you determine who gets payments and that sort of thing. And as David pointed out, the legislation does just call for a bipartisan commission or panel to study the issue and to study the mechanics of how to do it if, in fact, this is something that the United States ends up doing.
And this is actually something that Congressman John Conyers has been, I mentioned before, it's been floating for decades. Mm-hmm. He's been trying to introduce this legislation for decades.
Mm-hmm. And now it's Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has taken up the mantle, and she's the one that introduced this.
And why now, do you think? I mean, the Democrats have had the opportunity in the past. Why now?
Yeah. Well, one of the points that David made, you have a couple of or several of the Democratic presidential candidates who have been out and very public about on this issue, favoring a commission to study the issue, saying they're willing to look at it and that sort of thing. And it's, you know, when you have candidates for president talking about it, it automatically raises the profile. Anything they talk about automatically raises the profile of whatever the issue is. And I think that is some of what's driving it.
And what is the Republican response to the effort in general?
We've sort of overcome a lot of these issues in terms of racism. You had Senator McConnell earlier this week point to the election of Barack Obama as the first African American president in this country as an example of the U.S. sort of overcoming this racist past that some people say that we haven't fully dealt with. Mm-hmm. But I think Senator McConnell also said or suggested that it's been dealt with, and I think that even if this bill were to get out of the House, it would just not go anywhere when it got over to the Senate.
But does it matter that the conversation took place?
I think so, yes.
Okay. Also, from Congress, the Senate has approved a $4.6 billion spending bill in the wake of a recent surge of undocumented families at the border. Most of this money is going to go to housing, and it's going to be for taking care of unaccompanied children. It does not include funding for a border wall. But I want to get an understanding of what's the ticking clock at the border in regard to this money needing to get there. We're at a point where bills are high and the money's not there.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's worth noting that the vote in the committee was 30-1. Which is extraordinary, the one being Senator Merkley from Oregon, who's concerned about enforcement provisions. Mm-hmm. But there are some concerns in the House about this, but I think it's going to happen because the clock is ticking and no one quite knows.
And describe the ticking clock. What are the stakes right now?
Well, you have more and more people surging up from Mexico, being held in these detention centers. But more important, Health and Human Services is basically out of money. They canceled the soccer games. They canceled the various programs for these children. They just don't have the money. This gives them $2.8 million. Something like 50,000 children, I think, have been referred to HHS, and they simply can't provide for them. So there's your ticking clock.
Susan?
Yeah, I mean, what's happening here in the context is really an escalating crisis. You can argue over whether President Trump is responsible for triggering it or not, but the crisis that he's long been warning about definitely now exists in the sense that there are been a spike, as you know, in numbers of people coming across the border this year at a time when funding is insufficient to take care of those asylum seekers. Absolutely horrific reporting coming right now out of shelters in which children are being held, and they're not even being able to be cared for in a proper way because the number of beds is simply inadequate. There literally are not the dollars for this. And so you have these unbelievable reports this week. You can't even think that this is the United States. You are talking about children who are not being provided with diapers, who are not being taken care of, who are not being turned over as they're legally required to be in a timely fashion from the Border Patrol to the HHS and to the care of people who might be able to provide for them. So that's the specific financial crisis that you're talking about, but it comes in the bigger picture context of a complete impasse, a complete gridlock. The president has made the immigration debate over his wall, right, and over funding for it. He shut down the government earlier this year to do so. And yet, there's no realistic possibility at this moment for a bigger immigration compromise in Congress or with Democrats that would address the structural issues. And so, you know, just a week ago, I know it seems forgotten because we're now talking about war with Iran, but it was actually just 1 week ago that we were talking about the president's threat to close down the borders and essentially to stick up the Mexican government and demanded an enormous concession from them. He claimed that he made a secret deal with Mexico, in fact, over changing significantly the terms under which asylum would be granted. The Mexicans say there was no such arrangement. And so, you know, this is going to keep coming up over and over and over again because we are now in already a 2020 election context. That makes the prospects for any actual legislative fix that would be long-term between Democrats and President Trump extremely unrealistic, unfortunately.
Further on the immigration story, we ended up having a bit of a debate in Washington over the last few days over the meaning of the term concentration camps. What happened was that New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez sent a tweet accusing the Trump administration of operating concentration camps on the southern border. Her words were this: "This administration has established concentration camps on the southern border of the United States for immigrants, where they are being brutalized with dehumanizing conditions and dying. This is not hyperbole. It is the conclusion of expert analysis." That's the first tweet. She later added this one: "And for the shrieking Republicans who don't know the difference, concentration camps are not the same as death camps. Concentration camps are considered by experts as, quote, the mass detention of civilians without trial, close quote. And that's exactly what this administration is doing." Darlene, catch us up on what this controversy is about.
It's primarily about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right? Almost anything she says draws fire from the right and occasionally the left. And it's also a debate over her use of the word concentration camp and whether that description really applies to what's happening on the border. And as
because it evokes, for most people, it evokes extermination camps, yeah, murder camps, yeah, genocidal impulse of the Nazis. Yes.
Lots of bad images and bad imagery. And the administration and supporters of the administration would, you know, are pushing back strongly against that comparison.
I mean, even the use of the word extermination was used by Liz Cheney in a response to this, and AOC responded to her that that was in itself an offensive word, but it was one that the Nazis employed. But David, can we do a service in any sort of broad definition of concentration camp here?
Well, we reporters all went scurrying to the dictionary for concentration camp, and in fact, Ocasio-Cortez had it right. But I think you have to look at this not on an intellectual level, but on an emotional and a political level. And I don't know how this plays out eventually. Liz Cheney, who I think is number three in the Republican hierarchy, her comment was it demeans the memory of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. That reverberates, and a lot of people agree with that. So, again, we have to get away from just the intellectual discussion and understand how this reverberates emotionally, and that's a very, very tough thing to evaluate.
The CEO of Boeing offered up a public apology this week for the deaths of 346 people who died in separate flights aboard his company's plane. Kevin McAllister says he is remorseful for the loss of lives, but that Boeing is working hard to fix the problems with its 737 MAX planes to get them back in service. Also this week, famed pilot Sully Sullenberger, who famously landed a troubled aircraft on the Hudson River several years ago and saved everybody on board, appeared before the House Transportation Committee, and he testified about what it was like being in a Boeing 737 MAX simulator that recreated the company's fatal flights in Indonesia and Ethiopia. It sounded like this.
I recently experienced all these warnings in a 737 MAX flight simulator during recreations of the accident flights. Even knowing what was going to happen, I could see how crews could have run out of time before they could have solved the problems. Prior to these accidents, I think it is unlikely that any U.S. airline pilots were confronted with this scenario in simulator training.
So I want to point out, that's not looking good for Boeing, and yet, interestingly, a major British airline operator has just ordered 200 Boeing 737 MAXs. So that story's going in two directions. Before we go, a little Jeopardy trivia. If you haven't heard this news already, 78-year-old Jeopardy host Alex Trebek announced in March that he has stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
Now, normally, the prognosis for this is not very encouraging, but I'm going to fight this. And I'm going to keep working, and with the love and support of my family and friends, and with the help of your prayers also, I plan to beat the low survival rate statistics for this disease.
Panelists, have a Jeopardy question for you. Which former Jeopardy champ donated a portion of his or her winnings this week to a charity walk aimed at finding a cure for pancreatic cancer? Does anyone know? Everyone's shaking their heads. I'm going to tell you, it's James Holzhauer, who was the professional gambler who just went through an amazing run this past season on Jeopardy. He racked up nearly $2.5 million in prize money during his 32 game winning streak that ended a couple of weeks ago. He fell just $50,000 short of the all-time record for earning money. That belongs still to Ken Jennings, but it's nice to see him giving something back. So, sorry you didn't have the answer to that question, but I want to thank Darlene Superville for joining us.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. Susan Glasser, thanks for being with us. And David Lightman, have a great weekend. 1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, and technical help comes from Josephine Neonai. The digital team is Catherine Fink and Gabrielle Healy. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. In a moment, we'll be diving into international news. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from the American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org.
This is 1A. I'm John Donvan in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. So what is going on at the White House? Last night, President Trump approved, and then he rescinded, military strikes against Iran. This came soon after Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone. That followed attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman and an increase in U.S. troops in the region. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup, and we will be talking about Iran and also an upcoming U.S.-led summit in Bahrain, Hong Kong's latest fight with Beijing, why hundreds of thousands are fleeing the Democratic Republic of Congo, and more news from around the world. Joining me for this conversation first in the studio, Nadia Bilbasi. She is the Washington Bureau Chief for El Arabiya. Nice to have you back on 1A, Nadia.
Good to be back.
Also in studio with us, Barbara Platt-Usher. She is State Department correspondent for the BBC. Thanks for joining the roundup, Barbara.
Good to be here.
And from NPR in New York City, Ravi Agrawal, managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. Ravi, great to have you back on the program.
Great to be back.
So we have this this unfolding story of the president coming within minutes, according to the way he's described it. Within minutes of an attack taking place on Iran, and then he pulled back from it. We know about this because he tweeted about it. The first tweet he sent out, and that came this morning. On Monday, they shot down, and I'm reading now his tweet. On Monday, they shot down an unmanned drone flying in international waters. We were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night on three different sites. When I asked how many will die, 150 people, sir, was the answer from a general. 10 minutes before the strike, I stopped it. The tweet continues to a second tweet in which he explains it was not proportionate to shooting down an unmanned drone. Barbara, what's going on?
We've all been trying to figure that out for the past 12 hours. So apparently, according to Mr. Trump and multiple reports, there was serious consultations at the White House yesterday, during which time it was decided to launch targeted military strikes at three sites in Iran, including radar and military batteries. And then 10 minutes, according to Mr. Trump, before they were set to go, he called it off because he felt too many civilians would die. Now, I don't know. I guess, well, sure, you can call things up 10 minutes before they happen, but it sounds very dramatic. And it seems like he's sending a message of, on one hand, a warning, but also that he's of restraint. I mean, we know all along that he hasn't really wanted to go to war.
You mentioned that this was cooking already yesterday. Let's listen to some of what the president had to say when he was asked about this yesterday.
This drone was in international waters. Clearly, we have it all documented. It's documented scientifically, not just words. And they made a very bad mistake.
How will you respond?
You'll find out.
Are you willing to go to war with Iran?
You'll find out.
So, Ravi, we already have this disagreement about where this drone was located. What is the U.S. saying, and what are the Iranians saying?
Well, the U.S. says that the drone was in international waters and therefore it should not have been shot down. And Iran contradicts that and says that the drone actually had crossed into what it considers to be its territory, its waters, and that's why it was well within its rights to do so. But even though that is sort of hidden in the fog of war, as it were, there is so much that has happened in the last day that simply doesn't add up. I mean, as we were just describing, I mean, if Trump did indeed discover only 10 minutes before his pre-ordered strike would have hit its targets, that it was also going to kill 150 people, that begs all these questions about why those considerations weren't taken into account right at the start. So that was very confusing. And then also the soundbite that you just played from yesterday when he was speaking to reporters in the White House, that was also confusing because it seemed there that he was making all these moves to de-escalate, to offer sort of an off-ramp by saying that, you know, first of all, this was an unmanned drone and there wasn't a human being inside there, so it wasn't that serious. But then he also said that that it was likely conducted by someone who was loose and stupid and thereby, you know, offering a sort of off-ramp to save face both for the Iranians and for himself. And then to add to all of this, what still doesn't really add up is where this is headed and what Trump's policy is. Because on the one hand, he's made so clear that he's in favor of maximum pressure, but also that he's against military confrontation. And that's a contradiction because both of those things can't be simultaneously true. One leads to the other. So it's a very complicated game of chess that we're stuck in. But we know that you can't play it on the fly.
Nadia, we know that the president, as Ravi just said, has not been a leader who's been very enthusiastic about the placement of U.S. troops abroad and their deployment abroad. At the same time, he has people around him who are take a very, very hard line on Iran, like his national security advisor, John Bolton. Is he caught, do you think, between competing mentalities, his own on the one hand and his experts on the other?
Well, it's hard to tell how the president is thinking, but before he came to the White House on the campaign trail, he always talked about this waste of billions of dollars in the Middle East, useless wars. He objected to the invasion of Iraq, and he withdrew troops from Syria recently. So he definitely doesn't want to have any U.S. troops in a kind of a fighting force in the Middle East. But at the same time, yes, we have people like Bolton and like even Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who believes that you have to stand up to Iran somehow, and that the economic sanction absolutely has been working and is forcing Iran to change its course. And maybe the provocation that we have seen now, whether attacking the ships in the Fujairah port or the recent attack on the tankers, was not enough for Iran. So they wanted to draw the attention of the United States militarily. And therefore, for the first time, and this is what's remarkable about yesterday, for the first time, the Iranians said, yes, we did it. We shot that plane. And the president came and said, like, no, it was by mistake. It couldn't be the Iranian regime. And people who understand the region very well and understand totalitarian regimes think, they realize this is not a rogue element who decided all of a sudden to shoot a plane like this one. One of the most advanced in surveillance and in spying. It's worth $120 million to shoot it out of the blue. So I think that the president retracted. What doesn't make sense at all is what he said. He had a meeting yesterday morning with all his top lieutenants, whether the acting defense secretary or others. And obviously he would ask the first question, which is, what would that entail, this military attack? How many people will be killed? So they would have told him then, we cannot wait till 7 p.m. And then the president comes out and said, okay, I'm calling off the strike. Now, there's people who believe that it is more complicated than that. There is also that discussion from the Israelis, maybe Hezbollah will retaliate, and it will draw us into a wider war. And also, this is not Al-Qaeda or Daesh, where you can hit them and the Syrian regime, when he did after the use of chemical weapons, that they will hit them and they will wait and see. This is the Iranians. So if he attacked them, they will attack back and the United States will be forced to attack again. So before we know it, we're dragged into war.
Barbara, would the Iranians have any interest in trying to raise tensions?
Yeah, I think they would, although they would also be playing quite a dangerous game because there's no way that they can fight a conventional war with the United States and win it. That's just not it's never been possible, and it's not possible now, especially because they've been economically weakened so much. But they feel trapped. It seemed at first that their strategy in dealing with this maximum pressure campaign was to see if they could sit it out and wait until U.S. elections and maybe Donald Trump would lose and then a new Democratic administration would change course. But then what we had a couple of months ago, the Trump administration cut all waivers which allowed a certain amount of oil transactions to still continue, really sort of cutting the Iranians off at the knees. And since then, we have seen a slow and steady build-up in tensions. So it might be in their interest to take certain amount of action that maybe doesn't go too far, but enough to get everybody worried, just to sort of put themselves out there on the global stage, make themselves a crisis, and in particular try and get those people who don't agree with U.S. policies, such as the European allies, also the Asians who like to buy lots of oil, to try and put pressure on the Trump administration to change course. But it is playing quite a dangerous game because the calculation, A, is very difficult, but also because there's no communication between the Iranians and the Americans. So there's no way to have this sort of what the Americans call an off-ramp. They're sort of playing blind.
We're hearing our audience is very interested in taking part in this conversation, and we're hearing from Brian from Bartlett, New Hampshire. He writes, despite what we think of Iran these days, if we push them to the brink, should we be surprised when they lash out? And Marie writes in an email, Putin has stated very clearly he didn't think the U.S. should retaliate against Iran. Does anyone know if Trump spoke with Putin in the last 24 hours or so? That could be the very reason he changed his mind about an airstrike. Putin speaks, Trump jumps! Exclamation mark. Okay, that's a little bit of a tweak, but the question actually is on the table.
Unfortunately, the White House stopped releasing the calls between the president and foreign leaders. We used to rely on that. So sometimes it takes like 3-4 days before they acknowledge it. It happens, for example, with General Haftar in Libya, that we discovered that the president praised him. And that was significant in terms of the what they said during this call. But maybe a few days later, the White House might say and come that actually he spoke to President Putin. But also it's not just the Russians, the European allies. Mm-hmm. Let's remember that even when they attacked the tankers and the U.S. went out of their way, the Navy, the Centralcom put this videos and photos to show actually that the Iranians, because they had this magnetic mine that, the Iranians stuck at the bottom of the ship. And only the British came, which is the ally of the United States, almost like 24 hours later to say, yes, we agree with the United States, while the other allies, the French, the Germans, they kept silent a little bit. So even if you think the Russian position is known, but the United States allies didn't come to support them. And this is why the reluctance, I think. So maybe it could be an influence from Putin, but also it could be the president himself, because he's so unpredictable. We don't know how he thinks.
I want to, with that, spend a little bit more time, Ravi, on the issue of Iran and what's going on. Now, let's remember that part of the tension here is that Iran is suffering under sanctions that were reimposed when President Trump scrapped or pulled the U.S. out of a deal reached with several countries, including the United States and Iran, where they were going to stop development of their nuclear program for a period of time. So now we're hearing that the Iranians are making clear that they are pressing ahead with their enrichment of uranium. And my question is, where does this put the Europeans, our European allies, in the middle of this whole tense week?
It puts them in a very difficult situation, because even after President Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, they had said they would stick by Iran. And that assurance could have suggested that, that things could have, the status quo could have been maintained for a while at least. But with Iran taking the steps it's taken now, it really puts the Europeans in a tough spot. And I think increasingly they would need to distance themselves from an Iranian regime that clearly is acting out. It is clearly looking like it's feeling the pressure and it's lashing out in different ways. And, while we've been all using this movie analogy, and it may feel like that today, most movies end well. This may not end well, and it's still not over. We don't know whether the U.S. is going to take any other types of action today. We don't know if Iran will lash out in further ways and how that will react later down the road. So there are many things here that could still turn out quite badly. And among them is the fact that Iran doesn't really control all of its proxies who act in its name in Iraq, for example, or in other places. It's quite easy to imagine something going drastically wrong where an overzealous person tries to please the Iranian regime and decides to shoot something else down. As Trump described, may well could have happened, although that likely isn't the case. So there are still many things that could go wrong. And it all comes at a time when, remember, the U.S. has its third defense secretary in 6 months. And so it's not like there's real continuity in the White House either. And that makes it all a very tricky game. And it doesn't help that amidst all of this, Trump is sort of playing it on the fly and tweeting out sort of things that have make it sound more dramatic than it needs to be.
Iran, I think it always works with proxies. This is the modus operandi of the Iranian regime. So it's actually remarkable that so many rockets have been falling on the green zone in Baghdad. And although we heard Secretary Pompeo saying many times that targeting American interests in the Middle East is a red line that we're going to respond. Targeting our allies in the Gulf is going to be something that we have to respond to. But actually nothing has happened. So the bottom line is the Iranians, I think they wanted to negotiate on the nuclear deal, but they wanted a price for that. And the price is to lift the sanctions, because the sanction has crippled them. Mm-hmm. And this is why this administration thinks it's very effective. And this is a reason why they shouldn't go to war, at least for the time being. But you cannot calculate how the Iranians are thinking. Normally, they use the proxies and refrain from using any act by themselves, but this act, the last one, which is downing of this plane, it shows some people think it's a desperate act, that they really wanted the U.S. to be engaged, and to engage only to ask for calmness and to ask both sides to sit down and to say, okay, let's negotiate, in exactly a kind of analogous to what the President Obama did, that we lift the sanction and we're going to sit down and we talk, except that now it's, of course, so many different angles into it.
Charlie on Facebook jumps into the conversation saying, President Trump is fantastic, exclamation mark, without a single shot fired. He has Iran quaking and second-guessing their actions. Barbara, interesting perspective that what some have said is hesitation or indecision is actually was a head fake. It was a feint. It was very deliberate. What do you think of that?
Well, I can't say whether Mr. Trump's been deliberate or not. It's very hard to sort of calculate exactly what he's up to. But certainly that tweet and this discussion about military strike was a message. No doubt about that. And it's interesting that the Iranians, as reported by Reuters, said they actually got a message from Mr. Trump through the Omanis saying, I'm about to launch military strikes, but I really don't want war and I'd really like to talk to you. Can you decide now? And apparently they said, no, we can't, because the Supreme Leader has to decide. And so we'll relay the message. But, you know, I, whether or not that's true, it does show this sort of element of brinkmanship that Mr. Trump has employed in other areas.
Is it not on the other side, though? I mean, look at the choice the Iranians made to shoot down an unmanned aircraft. It was a very expensive aircraft. I think you said
$120
million. $120 million just fell into the ocean. Mm. But no American life was lost. And I can imagine it would have been very, very different reaction if we lost a pilot. So the Iranians, that was no accident that they chose that kind of aircraft.
No, certainly not. In fact, again, a military commander said later, well, there was another plane in our airspace around the same time that had 35 people on it, and we didn't shoot it down. So they're both kind of sending these messages of warning, but also restraint. And I think Nadia's right. Somebody needs to sit down and get them talking. But if the purpose of the maximum pressure strategy, which is to squeeze Iran's economy as tightly as possible until it's forced to the table to negotiate, where does that lead? There doesn't seem to be any diplomatic space for that to happen.
And if I may jump in, just to add that with Trump saying that it would be a red line of sorts if a human life would have been lost, it sort of does lock the United States as well into acting in a much more muscular fashion if indeed that were to happen, either through Iranian design or by a mistake.
And also, Ravi, it strikes me that on the point you're making, that the fact that he might have drawn that red line also justifies his decision to call off the attack because of the loss of life on the other side. In other words, you didn't kill one of our guys, I don't want to kill one of your guys, has a certain consistent logic to it.
It does. I mean, it begs the question why the strike was commissioned in the first place if he knew earlier that lives could be lost. But granted, let's say he discovered later and let's say he called it off for that reason. Sure, but it still locks the United States into acting more muscularly later. And that's the whole problem here, in that you can be in favor of maximum pressure. It can work. But then you can't be as against military confrontation as Trump says he is, because one leads to the other. And so there's a bit of contradiction there in Trump's stated policy so far, or at least what we know of it.
Richard in Portland, Oregon writes, an economic blockade is in fact an act of war. People suffer, people die. Our economic war is disproportionate. Let's move on to this conference that's taking place in Bahrain next week. Again, it's organized by the Trump administration. An attempt by the Trump administration, ostensibly to move toward an Israeli-Palestinian peace. It's being led by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. It is designed to discuss the economic dimension of an Israeli-Palestinian peace initiative. However, neither Israeli nor Palestinian representatives will be there. The Palestinians have refused to come. The Israelis were not invited. Nadia, who will be there?
Well, it will be the Gulf States, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, the Bahrainis who are hosting this, Morocco and Egypt. And the Jordanians have not made up their mind yet. The White House says this is the first phase of what they called another second political plan. The Palestinians, of course, are very suspicious. They think this is the only thing that they're going to present, and actually there is no political plan. And it reminds them of what the Israelis have been presenting for years, which they call the economic peace, that the Palestinian issue is not about justice. It's not about final status issues, because actually this president and this administration almost liquidated them. They announced Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. They announced the Golan Heights under the Israeli sovereignty. They cut aid to the Palestinian refugees and in a way trying to take away the refugee issues. Border is always insecurity under the hands of the Israelis and the control of the Israelis. So it's nothing almost left in the final status issues. The two-state solutions that every administration has been talking about since Carter till now is no longer on the table. This president, when he came, he said, look, I don't care, two-state, one-state, whatever. So in a way, the Palestinians were...
He said that.
Mm-hmm. And the Palestinians were encouraged. They said, like, maybe he thinks out of the box. Let's try something new. Mm-hmm. But then when you look at the details, is the plan has been so tightly held, so we don't know anything about it. And only three people who knows about it, which is Jared Kushner, Jason Greenblatt, and the Israeli ambassador, David Friedman, the American ambassador to Israel. So the Palestinians not even being invited or not, that they were coming or not coming, but basically they made a point. I will say that, yeah, absolutely, Gaza is a human disaster. They need to do something there. And even the West Bank. But if they did that in a good will, trying to bring the international community with the White House, it's not just a business community, but also NGOs and government representatives, etc. But if they did that before they shut down the PLO office in Washington, before they declared Jerusalem as a capital, before they cut down aid to hospitals in East Jerusalem, Palestinian hospitals, then maybe that's a goodwill gesture. But now after they did everything and they say to the Palestinians, we're going to put you on the corner, we're not going to invite you. We're having this grand wedding, but we forgot to invite the bride and the bridegroom, the bride and the groom, and therefore you have to accept what we're going to present. But who's invest and where? Mm-hmm. How can you invest in a place where you have security checkpoints? The movement between the West Bank and Gaza is almost impossible. And which money? With whose money? So all these details are a little bit unknown.
Ravi, this conference. One more point on this conference. Is it meaningful at all if the Palestinians and Israelis are not there?
It's hard to say. I don't think so. I mean, as Nadia put it so eloquently, it's a big party without the bride and the bridegroom. And so it's difficult to see any real substantive dialogue given the security situation, given the lack of decision makers who would allow real investments to take place or who would be able to fix problems with the security situation to allow real investments to take place. And it's not just investments, but it's also development, which requires, it's so connected to the political scene as well. It's difficult to imagine that this will be of any use, really.
Barbara?
Just to add quickly also, there are two phases, as Nadia said, the economic and the political, and everybody wants to know what's in the political. But that is going to be delayed now, of course, because of the Israeli political situation.
Remind us of what's
happening
there.
Which is that Prime Minister Netanyahu won an election, but then he couldn't put together a coalition government. So there's going to be another election in a few months. And he has quite a right-wing supporters, right-wing coalition. And to have a peace plan presented right at this time is exactly what he wouldn't want. So they're going to delay that part of it, at least until after the election sometime in autumn. So that has taken a lot of momentum out of any kind of a result that you could have got from this meeting in Bahrain.
One country that is going to be taking part in the Bahrain summit is Saudi Arabia, which is also in the news this week for a different reason. First, the Senate has blocked the president's plans to sell more weapons to the kingdom. And we got word of a new report on the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, which happened in Turkey last fall. What happened is that the UN's special reporter on extrajudicial summary and arbitrary executions, whose name is Agnes Callamard, released a report that says, among other things, that Saudi's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, did have a role in Khashoggi's death. Here she is speaking with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly earlier this week.
all of the evidence I have collected point to the responsibility of the state of Saudi Arabia. So that was a state-sponsored killing. The notion that the murder of Mr. Khashoggi was a rogue killing simply is belied by the evidence.
And but to be clear, you found no smoking gun that the Crown Prince directly ordered this?
This is outside my mandate. I am conducting a human rights inquiry, not a criminal investigation. Nevertheless, what I have found is that there is sufficient evidence demanding a follow-up criminal investigation with regard to the Crown Prince.
Ravi, I mentioned very briefly that Khashoggi was murdered in Istanbul last fall, but flesh the story out for us. What actually happened to him there?
Sure. Well, he walked into the Saudi consulate there, and it's very clear now that there was a premeditated set of plans that were in place to detain him and then to eventually kill him. And as the UN investigation shows, although some of these details, in fact, several of these details we already knew, they had real plans in place to kill him quite brutally and then to dispose of that body. And we know all of these things because Turkish intelligence, and this is also quite surprising and amazing in the story, that they had video surveillance outside, audio surveillance inside, and so they were able to record many of the conversations leading up to the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist and dissident who was writing for the Washington Post at the time. That, of course, that killing then sparked off a real sort of international kerfuffle between the United States and Saudi Arabia. But really, one of the things to come out of this report as well is the strengthening of the connection directly to the Crown Prince. And so even though Saudi Arabia has made such a show of these trials that they're holding to find people accountable for the killing, it's really just a show trial, as Agnes Callamard has pointed out, in that there's really not real accountability there, and it doesn't go all the way anywhere near as much as it should.
Nadia, do we see Saudi Arabia ever opening up to an international investigation there?
I don't think so. I think they see it as a question of sovereignty. And we heard yesterday from the State Minister for Foreign Affairs, Adel Joubir, saying that it was a painful crime. What happened to Jamal Khashoggi and his murder was not acceptable. It's a heinous act. And there is a process of trying 13 people, and the process is still going on. And he criticized this human rights report, and he said it violates international conventions. Mm-hmm. I don't think they talked to the Saudis directly or to the U.S., according to Joubir. And he said it's not acceptable for the kingdom. So whether they will allow international investigators, I think that's doubtful.
Just to add to that, one thing this does is it refocuses attention on Khashoggi's murder, because that had gone quiet for a while, and now it's come back and sort of interrupted the Saudis' attempts at diplomatic rehabilitation, if you want to call it that. Probably not with the Americans, because the President and the Secretary of State have, although they've deplored the killing, they've also made quite clear that this is a strategic relationship and they're not going to interrupt it. But it is having an effect in Congress, where there's always been quite a lot of pushback against this and over this fight over allowing weapons to Saudi Arabia. This has re-energized that.
Let's turn to Egypt. Really shocking story out of Egypt this week. Former President Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's only democratically elected president ever, who was deposed in a coup a few years ago, was on trial, and he died after collapsing in a courtroom. He was being tried for espionage. Ravi, remind us a little bit more about who Morsi was and also what he was accused of.
That's right. So Mohamed Morsi was essentially Egypt's first democratically elected president. And he was on trial in a Cairo courtroom and has essentially been imprisoned now for 6 years after the Egyptian military ousted him. And this was his defense minister, in fact, al-Sisi, who is now president. And he was ousted just a year after he came to power, And that was after the Arab Spring, of course, which led to elections and Morsi as a leader of the Muslim Brotherhood ended up becoming the president at the time. But really, I mean, what this all speaks to in Egypt is the larger situation of how the military is still completely in control. And if you think back to the start of the Arab Spring in 2011 when Mubarak was toppled and then the protests that led to Morsi coming to power, and how differently it's turned out for those two men, because Mubarak, of course, today is still alive and well. And Morsi, you know, after spending years in prison, dies in a courtroom in very ignominious circumstances and was not allowed to have a funeral in the way that his family wished. And so really it speaks to how it really is the military in control, as always, in Egypt. With no sign of democracy.
And speaking of the circumstances of Morsi's death, Turkey's President Erdogan got into this issue on Wednesday. He was at a rally and he told supporters, and I'm quoting him translated into English, "Mohamed Morsi flailed on the courtroom floor for 20 minutes and the authorities did not help him. This is why I say Morsi did not die. He was murdered." So he may be meaning it in a looser way than it might sound, but the UN is actually calling for an investigation into the former president's death. Do we know, Barbara, anything about what killed him?
Well, we know he was in very poor health. He had diabetes, he had liver disease, and he apparently just did not get the medical attention he was that would have helped him. In fact, there was a panel of British politicians and lawyers last year who reviewed his case, and they said exactly that. And they said if his medical care doesn't improve, then he could die. And that is what has happened. In fact, Human Rights Watch declares that he was singled out for mistreatment. And it's really quite a contrast. We were hearing there about the difference between him and Mr. Mubarak. Mr. Mubarak was also in prison for a while, but treated totally differently. Very good care, brought to the courtroom, you know, in his hospital bed and all the rest of it. And Mr. Morsi, it seems, just really suffered from things like from diseases that were not treated.
So we're so far, Nadia, from the optimism of the Arab Spring in 2011, which brought Morsi to power.
Absolutely. And I think the difference here as well is President Morsi came from the Muslim Brotherhood, which is loathed by the current regime and treated completely differently. So he was in solitary confinement for most of his 6 years. His family, his wife, I think his kids only saw him 3 times. They prevented him, obviously, from, as Barbara said, from giving him the medical attention that he needed. And he was caged in this glass cage in the court when he was defending himself. He spoke for 5 minutes before he collapsed. And according to reports, that it says that he was left for 20 minutes before he died of heart attack. Now, of course, President Erdogan as well, he comes from affiliation of the Muslim Brotherhood. So there was natural sympathy there and connection. But yes, the Arab world in general, I think they saw he was democratically elected, but he represented a movement that also dislike in the Arab world, which is the Muslim Brotherhood, that they believe ultimately that they will use democracy or the election as a mean to govern, and they will never give up power, just like Hamas in Gaza. They're happy to use it as a tool, but then they suppress the minorities and they don't give enough rights for everybody else. And Mr. Morsi he became a president by default. He wasn't even the choice of the Muslim Brotherhood. They had more dynamic leader, but he was disqualified because the Egyptian his opponents, they were worried actually he might win. But, you know, strangely enough, Morsi won the election. He didn't govern very well, but obviously he was arrested almost immediately after Mr. Sisi came to power.
The UN has published a report, released it this week, that says every minute in the year 2018, 25 people fled from their homes. It revealed that over the entire year, more than 70 million refugees left their homes to flee violence or oppression. It's 2019 now, and another crisis of the same sort, same focus, taking place in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the past 2 weeks. An estimated 300,000 people have left their homes. Nadia, what's happening in Congo?
You know, I used to be an Africa reporter, and I remember my last assignment in 2003 was in Eastern Congo. That's in Bunia, where now we're talking about these refugees. Look, there is a tribal conflict that's going on for a long time. And what happened during the genocide in Rwanda also affected Congo. This Great Lake region that was created during the Belgian colonial rule at the time, it left these tribes never united. And they always fight over territory or over land. But it became worse later on with a very corrupt political system. Congo itself, when it used to be called Zaire, by the way, 4 million people killed at one stage, but the whole world didn't pay attention. I mean, we know a little bit more about Sudan with 2 million dead, either because of the famine or the civil war, maybe because of celebrity like George Clooney, who adopted the cause of South Sudanese that led actually to the birth of an independent state in the South. But with Congo, it was kind of ignored, kind of part of Africa that people didn't really have any connection with because it was not the colonial power of the French or the British. It was the Belgian at the time, as I said. And now we have seen it's not just a civil war but this, that kills people, civilians that's been displaced. And this is a horrific number that we talked about, sexual violence as well that taking place in Congo, the mass killing of civilians, and on top of that they have the Ebola virus. So you can imagine
1500 people have died.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Imagine mm-hmm. the tragedy that these people live in, and not much kind of attention given from the international community.
So there is not. I was going to ask you, what is the response from the international community, and you're telling me not much.
Not much, because, look, first of all, I mean, they always say they have this fatigue of the African wars. And I remember whether it's covering Somalia or the conflict in the Great Lake region or, anywhere that you can see it between Ethiopia and Eritrea for the time being. It just short-lived, you know. People said, like, there is a disaster somewhere and you pay an attention. But now, especially now, what happened in the Arab world, this report that you mentioned, the 70 million people, five countries making two-thirds of the refugees. And most of them in the Arab world or the Muslim world, you have Syria, you have Somalia, you have Afghanistan, and you have the Palestinians as well from 1948. It's almost 7 million Palestinian refugees still living in neighboring countries. So, and on top of that, we have all this current conflict. So every conflict kind of, supersede the other, and we pay attention to the current one, and unfortunately, we'll forget the old ones.
I want to make some time to talk about what's happening in Hong Kong. Ravi, we have thousands of young protesters and enormous, enormous demonstrations taking place in Hong Kong's streets, blocking police force headquarters. And what they're angry about, interestingly, is a piece of legislation, an extradition bill. And these demonstrations have been going on now for 2 weeks, hundreds of thousands of people talking about this one piece of proposed legislation and how it's going to erode civil liberties, which they are up in arms about. What's going on there?
Well, as you say, it really is this proposed bill, essentially, that would leave many people in Hong Kong exposed to China's justice system, because if you would then commit a crime in Hong Kong, you could be extradited to China. And that, of course, would erode the judicial independence that Hong Kong has long had outside of China. And so that's sort of the flashpoint that has led to what are the biggest protests we've seen in Hong Kong. Essentially, if the numbers are to be believed, 1 in 4 Hong Kongers on the streets protesting against this potential bill. And even though the bill has been stayed, what they're really looking for is longer term promises that the bill won't come back, or that other such encroachments into Hong Kongers' way of life and their system and their independence will not come into question later. And so even though the question of Carrie Lam, who is the chief executive there, even though the question of her stepping down came up, they're not really focused on that, these protesters. What they're more focused on, in quite a laser way, is their list of demands, which includes a complete withdrawal of this bill. And of course, all of this is part of the larger issue of what exactly is Hong Kong, mm-hmm. Its history, where it's headed after the handover to China, and what that means for its future. Remember, the people of Hong Kong see themselves as quite different from mainlanders in China. They may In fact, that there's a lot of anger as well about mainlanders who come to Hong Kong, and they really want to preserve that sense of independence of who they are, of how they conduct business, of how they live their lives. And that's really what's at stake here.
Barbara?
Oh, I just wanted to say that another interesting element of the story is China and where its position is, because it has been backing the chief executive, Carrie Lam, and she stepped back. She didn't do as much as the protesters wanted, but she did reverse or push back or step back on her position. And that is also then a reversal for President Xi, because he's the one who appoints her. So it shows that there are still limits to his power on the one hand, but on the other hand, he has been governing with a more authoritarian style, and that's also what's galvanizing these protesters coming out and staying out, because the big story here is they don't want China to exert more control over their civil liberties in Hong Kong, and that has been the trend of President Xi in China, and they don't want that to happen in Hong Kong, and they're going to have to fight harder and harder for it, so get out the numbers, keep people out there. Plus, they have quite a history of doing it as well.
The New York Times released a report this week that says the U.S. military has been targeting Russian power plants. The report itself is not seen as surprising, but the reaction to it has been. Take us through very briefly, Nadia, what was in this report?
Yeah, it was it's a kind of a strange report, because the president jumped to describe it as treasonous. He said, like, this is an act of treason. So basically, the New York Times said that the Americans has implanted, or they have malware implants that affected the electricity grid that supplies hospitals and schools, and the Russians called it a new cyber Cold War. The Kremlin said that everything is under control. Our Secret Service, like, know exactly what happened, but it's just like, nobody knows why now, why it's breaking now, who's saying what. Are they really the Russians in control? Is it true or not? And apparently the prison wasn't informed about it. And
Let's talk about that, actually.
This is yeah. What's interesting, because his own intelligent officials didn't trust him.
We had David Sanger on the show earlier this week, who was involved in the reporting of that story for the New York Times, and here's what he said about that.
So there's an element of this that is just the new authorities, but there's also an underpinning of something that we have heard not only in the cyber arena, but generally, that the intelligence agencies and the military have been hesitant about going to talk to the president about Russia. We wrote a story a few months ago about Kristen Nielsen being told by the acting chief of staff at the White House not to go raise a program to counter election interference with the president, because it sets him off and makes him think about whether or not the Russians actually interfered on his behalf, which, as we know, gets him quite angry.
Barbara, do you find that credible, that they wouldn't be telling the president about something like this?
Well, I mean, also in Mr. Sanger's report, he said that the president had authorized this broadly in an executive order to be more aggressive on the cyber command front, that instead of waiting for adversaries to come and plant malware in the U.S. Utility system, you needed to go out and do it and send a message that way. So he had broadly agreed on it, but if he does get set off by any suggestion that there's a connection between Russia and cyber equals what happened to me in my election, that's the implication. He did have a contradictory response. He said it was, on the one hand, it was an act of treason, suggesting that it was true but shouldn't have been reported. And on the other hand, he said it was wrong. And you had an interesting, confused Mr. Putin, who responded by saying, I don't really know how we're supposed to interpret this. Does he mean they published real information or that they put out false information? So even Mr. Putin was saying, I'm not quite sure how to respond to Mr. Trump's comments.
I want to wrap things up by talking about a story that comes out of the sports world. It's the match between the U.S. and Sweden in the Women's World Cup, where things got pretty hot, because there's some history between the U.S. team and the Swedes. The last time they met was when in the 2016 Olympics, when the Swedes knocked the U.S. out, and there was some harsh words between some of the players. At least one of the players. Anyway, when this game took place, it was very watched, and the Swedish goalkeeper Hedvig Lindahl primed the pot by saying before the game that the Americans don't have the mental advantage that they had before. And so the game was played, and the U.S. beat the Swedes 2-0, and one of the two goals scored against the Swedes was an own goal. And what do you call that?
I don't know. I don't know anything about sport, unfortunately.
I think it's called karma. All right. I want to thank all of you for joining us. Ravi Agrawal, Managing Editor of Foreign Policy, thanks for being with us on 1A.
Thank you very much.
Nadia Bilbasi, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Arabiya. Great to have you on again.
Thank you.
And Barbara Plett-Usher, State Department Correspondent for the BBC. Thanks, Barbara.
My pleasure.
1A's senior team includes Danielle Knight, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Denise Couture. Miranda Fulmore edits the show. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm John Donvan. Joshua is back here on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. This is 1A.